Yes, okay, well, the German internees were linguists, sort of the Japanese prisoners had, because the Australian intelligence service couldn't do it. The other thing about the Australian intelligence service was this. In relationship, for instance, to the white papers and British policy concerning internees, they were very badly informed, and they borrowed documents from us. For instance, the various white papers, the Australian intelligence officers borrowed the materials from us because they didn't have any. The various white papers dealing with the release policy and so on. But they borrowed it from us. They weren't informed. That made them feel, I suppose it made them feel very, they were very annoyed about that because we told them things that they didn't know.
When did you actually return to Britain then?
I returned to Britain in 1942, and I sailed from Australia in July 1942 on a ship called the Themistocles and landed in Liverpool in October 1942.
Any contact with the enemy on the voyage back?
No. The only fright we had on the way back was that a short time before we left Fremantle, the Australian cruiser Sydney had been sunk by a German raider by the Deutschland. We knew about this, and in the middle of the ocean between Fremantle and Durban, we had an alarm, and because smoke was seen on the horizon, and we were very, very concerned about this. The domestic was took evasive action and went south at its maximum speed, but it turned out that it was a convoy from the British destroyers, which had gone off course, and so this was second. We were actually the internees on the Themistocles were treated as civilians, and we were required to do watches on the ship, for instance, anti-submarine watches. We were we weren't actually part of the cruise, but we were used to do. Watches, for our watches, which was quite a job actually, and it was quite unpleasant from time to time. It was very cold.
How did the conditions on the journey compare with the Dunera?
Oh, the conditions on the journey back were absolutely wonderful. I mean, we had cabins, and the place was clean. We were fed properly, and it was very comfortable. The ship was very comfortable. It was a very pleasant, from the point of view of traveling, it was very pleasant. I spent a lot of time in the library. The ship had an excellent library. I read all the volumes of Macaulay's History on the way back.
And when you arrived back in Liverpool, what then?
In Liverpool, since I was not released, I was taken from the Themistocles and taken to the Isle of Man. And that was put into a boarding house, actually, in the Isle of Man. And it was very unpleasant, actually, on the Isle of Man. The places were very, the boarding houses were very cold. Dilapidated.
This is Douglas, is it?
Douglas, yes. It was awful. And but from the Isle of Man, I was taken to in November, I was taken to the tribunal in London, the Anderson Tribunal, and was interviewed there. And nothing much happened, though. All they were interested in was what would be my attitude towards Britain if Britain was involved in the war with the Soviet Union. And I was appalled at this questioning, because this was the time of the Battle of Stalingrad and also the Battle of in the Western Desert. And it was sort of a turning point in the war. And it was an incredible questioning. And I told them that if Britain wants to pursue a fascist policy, I'm opposed to Britain pursuing such a policy. But after that interview, of course, I was taken back to the Isle of Man and I was released on condition.
Why was it called a Henderson Tribunal?
Lord Henderson was the last ambassador to Germany, and he was the one who was responsible for the tribunals and organized the tribunals at that period. Yes. He was a person who organized, although he didn't appear at the tribunal in which I attended. I don't know who it was who attended the tribunals. Probably, I don't know who it was. But it was the Lord Henderson Tribunal.
And who were the personalities on the tribunal?
I don't really know who they were. On the previous occasions, I knew who they were. Yes? It was the Judge Burkitt, and it was one of the professors I knew, Professor of German, and I recognized a number of other people. But on that tribunal, I didn't recognize anybody. I don't know who they were. I presume they were intelligence officers, but I don't know.
So when were you released? Straight afterwards?
I was taken back to the Isle of Man, and I was released actually on the 21st of December, 1942. And I had some problems being released, because they wanted me to sign a document saying that I had no claim against the British government of any kind. I refused to sign it, and so I was taken back. But eventually what happened, there was a protest about not me being kept, and actually the leader of the Liverpool Labour Party, Alderman Luke Hogan, got in touch with Morrison, and I was, on the 21st, I was called before the commanding officer, and he said, "Will you sign?" I said, "No, I won't sign anything." And he said, "Get out." They gave me 10 shillings, and he said, "Get out." And I was given a travel warrant, and I went to Manchester.
Were you making a claim for financial compensation?
No, I had never made a claim, but I was asked to say that I wouldn't make any claims on principle, and I refused to do that. And eventually they said, "Get out." And I've never made a claim against the British government or for anything, although I lost a lot of. I mean, I lost a lot of clothing and typewriter and God knows what else on the Andorra staff, because I had a lot of things on the Andorra staff. I lost it for some reason, but I made no claim. I've never made a claim. I considered making a claim at that period of time was not in keeping with the situation.
Had you maintained your party membership?
Oh, yes. In the camps, the position was this, that the party organization existed in all the camps. It was the German Communist Party and the Austrian Communist Party, and I collaborated with them, yes. And in the camps, we paid party dues, yes. So we always had money, and actually in Tatura I had quite a lot of money. The tailor shop was very good, and what we did is we altered the uniforms of staying officers. Unfortunately for us, the Australian uniforms, the officer uniforms, fitted very badly. And they came to us and brought them, and they paid us cash, which was quite illegal. But we tricked them into this. We said we couldn't. They said it was illegal for them to pay us, and then we ripped their uniforms and we said, look, if you don't pay us, you can take your uniforms back, and eventually they paid us. And I have quite a bit of money, and we used the money. Oh, yes. And the other thing, because of the money I made, and others made some money, I made myself a suit and I bought some cloth. The Australian authorities assisted us in buying materials, also for the workshop, the joints workshop, but they also assisted me. I bought quite a lot of cloth and linings, and on one occasion it was difficult to buy linings, and the Southern Command of the Australian Army helped us to buy linings, and we got very good quality linings, and I made a beautiful suit for myself. I was very well equipped when I came back from Australia. I was very well dressed, I can assure you. I had some clothes given by the Jewish community, and I bought myself a leather coat, and I bought myself, I made myself a suit, and I bought myself shoes, and I bought myself some shirts. I was very well equipped. I made quite a bit of money, and with the money I bought cigarettes, and mainly cigarettes for some of our people who smoke animal smoke, and they suffered a lot. Those who couldn't make any money in the camps suffered a lot, especially if they couldn't buy any cigarettes, and we helped a lot of people with the money we made. And then when we, on the way back, we anchored both in Durban and also in Cape Town. And in Cape Town I used the money I had left to buy fruit. I bought boxes of pineapples and oranges and you name it, and apples, and I gave them to the various friends we had on the ship. I had plenty of money, but I spent all the money. I spent all the Australian money, and I could spend it in South Africa, but I couldn't spend it. I didn't have any left when I came to England. I don't think I had a penny left.
Now, coming on to the last years of the war, the second half of the war in Britain, can you tell me what you did then, please?
Well, after I was released, I went to Manchester, where my parents were living. And also my fiancée was living with my parents. And the first thing that happened to me, I didn't have any money. I had no money left at all, and the Communist Party gave me £5 in Manchester, and the trade union gave me £15 on the day I visited them, which was very useful. So on the Christmas, I had £20, which was quite a bit of money. I didn't expect it. And on the second or third day in the blackout, I had an accident. I fell over in the garden. I stumbled and I fell over a wall, and I broke some ribs, and it was very uncomfortable. But after it healed all right, and after a couple of weeks, I think already on the 6th of January, I started working, and I worked for a firm making uniforms. They were called Justman, and they made battle tests and RAF uniforms, and then eventually they worked for the American Army. And I was employed in the cutting room, and I'd been trained as a tailor's cutter before the war, and specialised on making lace. I don't know whether you know what that means. The ministry prescribed certain measurements for every uniform. You have to have a certain amount, they use a certain amount of cloth and a certain amount of linings. And I made lace, and I managed to save a considerable amount of materials for the Department of Defense by making very tight lace. I did this throughout the rest of the war. I made lace, designed lace. I don't know whether you know how this is done.
No.
Well, in order to cut a garment, you need a pattern. And lay the pattern on a piece of cloth, yes? And in order to achieve an economic result, you make it very tight. You fit one piece into the other, yes, sleeves and so on and so forth. And my job was to save as much material as possible. In relationship to the prescribed amount of cloth to be used for the uniforms. And I did very well at this. I did this during the rest of the war. I made tight lace and also cut out the lace. And I was employed in this factory till the end of the war.
Was this so you could help the war effort?
Well, my position was very, very strange. Of course, it was war production, yes. But I had curfew, and I was the only one who wasn't allowed to fire watch. Whilst I was released unconditionally, the conditions were attached to me. And one of the things was I had curfew, and I had curfew every day. I couldn't go out after 10 o'clock at night, and I couldn't go out before 6 o'clock in the morning. Why? God only knows. I don't know. But I had curfew. That meant I didn't do any fire watching. I never did any fire watching. Neither was I allowed to ride a bicycle. And whatever changes came about, I had to report to the police. Now, this raised some problems with the trade unions, because when I came back, I was, of course, a member of the Tailors and Garment Workers Union, and I resumed activities in the union immediately, and I was elected onto the regional committee. And not only that, I was also elected to the Manchester and Salford Trades Council, and I became a member immediately of the executive. And what happened then was that about the bicycle, for instance, the executive of the Manchester and Salford Trades Council took this up with the Lancashire Chief of Police, who then released me from the prohibition of riding a bicycle. And if you're interested, I can show you. I've got the note from the Chief of Police of the Manchester. I've got it in my alien's passport. And actually, the BBC was very interesting. They took a film at one time about this. And I resumed political activity. And I was a member of the executive of the Manchester and Salford Trades Council. And of course, I was also in the local branch of the Communist Party, although I wasn't on the leadership at that time. As a matter of fact, the Communist Party's attitude was that I should be very careful, because they didn't want me to they are leaving the world because they're afraid that this would be dangerous, because if, as a German, to take an active part in the politics of the Communist Party would be dangerous for them. So I was in that match, but I didn't play any leading role at all, but only in the trade union, because the Communist Party was very concerned. They were also very concerned that I should be very careful in associating with other Germans in the area. Oh, I kept in touch with some of the ex-Indonesian, but generally I kept away from the Germans because the Communist Party was very concerned. Then, since I had no extra war work to do except to work in the factory, I was appointed editor of a Communist Party newspaper, which I did in my spare time.
Called?
Latvian News. This newspaper was produced during the whole of the war. It was called Latvian News. Came out every week. And what it did deal with the position in Lancashire, and I read all the Lancashire newspapers. I was provided with all the Lancashire local newspapers, piles of them, and I took all the information from the newspapers, which were of interest as far as the pursuings of the war was concerned, and we highlighted it in this newspaper. I was the editor, and I got assisted in the editing of this newspaper by somebody from the Daily Express. The Daily Express was printed at the time in Manchester, you probably know this. And he was a proofreader of the Daily Express, and every week before the paper went to press, he proofread this, and it was very, very useful. But all my spare time was either the executive of the Manchester and Salt and States Council, I was working in the factory, and the rest of the spare time, especially the weekends, was always concerned with editing the newspaper and getting the newspaper out. And it was a very, very interesting. But I was not allowed to firewatch or do any other war work. And I had a strange experience. I also had permission to go to a Communist Party Congress in London. I had to go to the police to ask them to go to London, which I did do. And I was caught in the area, actually, remember at the time. And anyways, I was at this Communist Party Congress, and I had permission from the police to go there. But at the end of, towards the end of the war, after the invasion of Europe, there was a call, sort of a last push up for people to volunteer for war work, yes, or any special duties. And I went to the police in Stretford, and I saw the chief police officer and said, look, we've made this appeal for special duties, and I'm quite prepared to do this. What do you want me to do? And he said to me, you, we don't want you, get out. And that was the end. And I got out. The other thing that happened to me, which was very unfortunate, was very, very annoying. I lived with my parents at the time, and then my fiance, we found another place to live in now, actually, in Austin, Stafford. But whilst I was living with my parents, during the war, after their release from internment, they moved to Manchester. We had a house in Liverpool, which was bombed, and knocked out, and I moved them to London for a time. Then they went to Manchester and bought a house there. And they left some rooms to refugees and people who needed accommodation. It was a big house. And one day, one of the tenants, a young girl, I don't know her age now, but she was a young girl, and she was a refugee girl as well. And she came to my father, and she said to him, "I want to leave. I can't stay here. I can't stay in this house." And he said, "What's the trouble?" And she walked down, and she said that the police had called into the office in Manchester and told her to report on whatever I did and report on me, since she lived in the house. And she said she didn't agree and she didn't disagree, but she was not prepared to do anything like that. And she said to my father, "I must leave," and she did leave.
Well,
there was an attempt by the police to use somebody in my father's house to spy on me, and I was very annoyed, I can tell you. I was very annoyed.
Where was your refugee from?
She probably was either German or Austrian, I'm not quite sure, I can't remember her name either. But she was a refugee girl, and she lived with in my parents' house. But since they had a big house, they took in people that were... She wasn't the only one. But at that time, when I came back, and my fiancé lived there as well, she was the only one who lived in the house besides my parents, my mother, my father, my fiancé, and myself, and this girl. And they summoned her to the police head office in Manchester and told her to spy on me. That's really what happened. And she hadn't refused to spy on me. But she told my father she couldn't stay in the house under those circumstances, and she told him what had happened. And I was very annoyed, of course, she told me as well. And I was very annoyed. I thought it was outrageous to do that.
Did you complain to the police about that?
No, I didn't do anything. No, I didn't do anything. Because I didn't think it was worth it, because the police in general was quite hostile. And to me, for reasons I don't really know, I can't think why they should be hostile, because they didn't do anything. And whatever I wanted to do, I had to mobilize people, for instance, on this bicycle business. Yes, I had to get the Manchester and Salford States Council to get in touch with the Chief of Police of Lancashire to have this removed. Yes, and it's my Ellen's passport, and they did remove it because they insisted this was quite unnecessary, and it was because I rode a bicycle. Yes. It was very convenient to ride a bicycle. And I wasn't allowed to ride a motorbike. I had a motorbike as well. But my motorbike had been sold. My future wife had sold a motorbike during the war. And I was able to drive a car, but I didn't have a car at the time. And by the way, I wasn't allowed to go to Liverpool either. And eventually, I got permission to go to Liverpool because I had stored a number of all my books were actually stored in Liverpool. In fact, I was stored in Birkenhead, and I brought them to Manchester, but I had to get special permission to do this. And the police eventually, under pressure from the